and a Republican landslide in Syria, the first people to go down are these centrists, right? Because they're in districts that otherwise lean right. The progressives are in safe districts. And they're also making their own separate, you know, political leadership kind of calculations, like if Biden somehow hangs on, you know, these are chits that can be redeemed for things we want on our agenda. They also have a, you know, media image as being sort of fire-breathing and incendiary figures. So if they can come off at this moment as, you know, cautious and sensible and horse-trading figures, that redounds to their broader image in political discourse. So again, a lot's going on.
And we will, of course, continue to cover it. President Trump takes the stage tonight at the Republican National Convention. We'll be back tomorrow with 2 hours of War, Peace, and the Presidency Breaking with Convention. Chris Layman, want to thank you so much for being with us, D.C. Bureau Chief for the Nation. You can check out our other interview with him in the other hour of Democracy Now! Today. Democracy Now! Currently accepting applications for Director of Development to lead our fundraising team. Go to democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh for another edition of War, Peace, and the Presidency Breaking with Convention.
This is Norman Sylvester, the Boogie Cat. You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. This month's Board of Directors meeting will be held on Monday, July 29th at 6 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, more than 1,000 lightning strikes resulting in more wildfires. And forecasters say we can expect the danger to grow. Oregon counties are starting to get ready for a big change that's about to get underway on September 1st with a new state law making drugs illegal once again. And some big upgrades coming to Northwest Forests. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 18th, 2024. I'm Annette Newell. Thanks so much for joining us tonight. The Larch Creek Fire, the Lone Rock Fire, the Falls Fire, the Cow Valley Fire. These are the names of the wildfires torching tens of thousands of acres in Oregon and keeping thousands of firefighters busy trying to contain them, trying to minimize the threat to homes, properties, and lives. There's been a lot of outreach to local communities. Here's an example of just one of the informational community sessions, in this case for the Larch Creek Fire.
My name is Ron Graham. I serve as a liaison officer with the incident management team. I really want to welcome you all and thank you all for coming. Thank you for the support that you've given all the firefighters and first responders throughout this incident. The communities have all been really outstanding with support for us all, and we really appreciate that. The Larch Creek Fire started on Tuesday, July 9th. Conditions throughout the state were extremely warm. Temperatures were triple digit, over 100 degrees, extremely dry conditions. So immediately when this fire was detected and notified to folks, there was great response by not only the local responders, including ODAP and other federal partners, the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Forest Service. Quickly, the local responders knew that this fire was going to be a problem. Fire is no stranger to you all. Many of you have seen a lot of fires, probably more than I've seen, right? So quickly, there was an order placed for an incident management team called the Central Oregon Fire Management Services Interagency Type 3 Team, as well as the governor approved and declared a conflagration act, which allowed the state fire marshal to bring in structure protection resources as well as their incident management team. So that's day one, and that's happening pretty fast. By day two, the fire obviously continued to challenge firefighters, and the decision was made to order a Type 1 incident management team to basically come in and unify with the state fire marshal team and let the Type 3 team go back to another work. That Type 3 team came here directly from another fire that they were managing. So they'd been out and they'd been working hard for several days. The two teams, the state fire marshal team and the ODF Type 1 team, became unified command. So we worked together through our first real operational shifts, getting the resources that we needed to get. Currently, this fire is the top priority fire in the nation. So it's getting the resources that it needs, and that's a good thing. We've got 18,387 acres estimated burned by our latest mapping, and about 800 or more firefighters now on scene. A lot of good resources on scene, really making a lot of good work. And we've had some favorable weather here and there, despite these continuing challenging circumstances with the weather.
The Larch Creek wildfire is now about 43% contained. Counties throughout Oregon have to get ready for a new state law taking effect in September, House Bill 4002, which will once again make possession of drugs illegal, but also provide avenues to avoid criminal charges by going to drug treatment. In Oregon's most populated county, Multnomah, leaders are meeting, trying to find out what's the best way forward.
My name is Jay Scroggins. I used to work for the Department of Community Justice, and I'm here to talk about what DCJ will be ready for September 1 for our share of what 4002 implementation is. We are hoping, of course, that the law enforcement diversion side of things is robust, works, and that we actually don't get a lot of people making it to where the law enforcement deflection process doesn't work for whatever reason, and they get actually put through the criminal justice system and placed on supervision DOS. Just to remind everyone, that happens September 1. And in the case that someone does go through the official court system, the first option will be what's called a conditional discharge. That period of time is a 12-month supervision. That's the lowest amount of probation time that we are used to here. Most probations are 18 months, 24 months, and 36 months. This will be a 12-month period of time that's a conditional discharge, which we see is also a deflection type of system. The goal is to get these people in, have them referred to treatment, help them with the resources so that they can attend treatment, get done with treatment, and then ask for early termination of their conditional discharge, which will have that case removed from their criminal record. If that doesn't work, they would be placed on what's called an unclassified misdemeanor for up to 18 months supervision to us. And we supervise that like we do any other misdemeanor supervision, still with the hopes of getting them to treatment so that they are better and get off of supervision, and we can actually do what's called earned discharge in that process. Same issue, we can ask that the case be expunged after about 90 days of them being exited from our system. Both of those systems, we will be ready to go on September 1. Hopefully, we don't see our first people for much, much later, and that this deflection piece really works. But we will be ready regardless. The way that we're going to do that, we're going to have dedicated cases both at the East office on 122nd and the West office, our Mead building on 6th Avenue. We will be ready September 1 for those people to be received. When we receive a person on conditional discharge or on that probation, and they're already existing on a caseload to us for another crime, we're going to maintain the PO that already has that person. We think that benefits the continuity of services, the relationship that we've had. If they come in and they already are on another caseload, this will just be a tracking case with those same goals, same rules that any other standalone 4002 case will have. If someone comes to us who's only on for a 4002 possession of controlled substance case, they are going to go to these designated people. They're going to do it right the same way every time, same goals, same expectation, get them to treatment, get them the help, the resources that they need, have them complete with where we can then get them removed from our criminal justice system as soon as possible. We will monitor all 4,002 cases at all risk levels. Right now, if you came to DCJ, we have a risk-based system. These people need attention. We want these people to get the attention and the commitment that they show to treatment, get into treatment. We're going to be there to help them along the way if there's struggles with treatment. Even if you're a low-risk person who comes to DCJ on a 4,002 case, you will be seen by these caseloads. You will not go to a case bank where you're just going to fend for yourself. We are going to supervise everybody so that they all have the same expectation and get the same amount of attention to their needs to be successful. So there's these two things, early termination and earned discharge. So if they complete treatment, we close the case. We ask that early termination be administered by the courts, and the courts have 90 days to either expunge the case or not. Earned discharges for the next group, the people who don't successfully complete a conditional discharge and are now put on for a regular misdemeanor probation. We don't have to get permission from the courts to get someone off. We are going to analyze the past possession of controlled substance trends and try to estimate how many people do we think that we might see on our caseloads. If we didn't have deflection, if 4002 didn't exist and all that the legislature did was say, possession of a controlled substance is a crime again that comes back to us, I could tell you we probably get around 400 to 500 people in a 2-year period of time. We hope that deflection works great, and that number is much, much lower, that people don't make it to our caseloads, that they actually take advantage of these resources, get clean, get well, get healthy, and don't get more engaged in our systems. So it's tough to tell how that's going to be at this time, but we're going to be monitoring this at all times. We're going to be able to hopefully tell you how many, but what is their risk profile? What are some of their histories? How many of these people came to us because of a failed deflection? And how many people came to us just because they just came straight from the police officer, like they didn't get a crack at deflection? We are working closely with our partners at the state as they build our budgets for the projected population. So we are tracking that as closely as we can.
In our KBOO Evening News Health Beat report today, an OBGYN doctor and professor from the Pacific Northwest wants to educate people about the facts about abortion. Dr. Sarah Prager is an OBGYN physician and a professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington. She is also the director of the Family Planning Division at the University of Washington.
Talking and working with abortion and contraception and miscarriages is what I spend most of my time doing. What is an abortion? An abortion is the act of doing or taking something that ends a pregnancy. And that may sound obvious, but I think it's worth talking about for a second what is and what is not an abortion and what are we including. Generally, when we talk about abortion, we are not also including ectopic pregnancy, which is a pregnancy outside of the uterus, or a spontaneous abortion, which is a miscarriage. So why do we say induced abortion sometimes? You'll probably have heard that mentioned as well. And we do that to differentiate from a spontaneous abortion. So taking something that ends a pregnancy versus a pregnancy ending spontaneously, which is a miscarriage or a pregnancy loss. And generally speaking, we avoid the term elective abortion because that indicates some judgment that this is something that maybe doesn't need to happen and all abortions are indicated for some reason. I also just like to remind everybody that language does matter. And how we talk about abortion has really wide implications. It can matter to our patients and to other individuals that they're associated with, both those who have abortions and those who may need one in the future. It also can really matter to people who perform abortions, like I do and other colleagues of mine. It has huge implications on legislation and on regulation. So let's understand a little bit more. What is a medication abortion? A medication abortion is taking a combination of medications, typically in the first 11 to 12 weeks, and that combination includes a mifepristone tablet that a patient swallows, followed usually in 24 to 72 hours by 4 misoprostol tablets that are administered by themselves at home. If the pregnancy is beyond 9 weeks, then generally speaking, the dose of misoprostol needs to be repeated at least one time, and the passing of the pregnancy also occurs at home. There are also some misoprostol-only regimens that are available. Typically requires more doses of the misoprostol to achieve a similar efficacy than if using pretreatment with mifepristone, and there are more side effects. We find in Washington State that it's been incredibly helpful to have this available, particularly for people who live rurally. Mifepristone, the first medication of the medication abortion, is still really highly regulated through a system called the REMS, which stands for Risk Evaluation and Mitigation Strategies. This is an FDA system. This is applied typically to medications that are very dangerous or potentially life-harming and is used to assess safety of use. And then typically the REMS go away after safety has been confirmed. These REMS have been in place for well over a decade for mifepristone, in spite of the fact that it's an incredibly safe medication. They include restrictions like mifepristone cannot be prescribed through a pharmacy like most other medications. There has to be a provider that is registered to be able to even receive mifepristone to dispense in a clinic. And if they want to prescribe through a pharmacy, both the provider and the pharmacy need to specifically register that medication. Pharmacies also have to consent to carry mifepristone, and only one pharmacy in Washington State, for instance, currently carries mifepristone. It is possible now, through some adjustments to the REMS that happened during and post Dobbs, that mifepristone can be mailed from a registered pharmacy to a patient, although that patient still needs to be living in the state where that medication is prescribed and mailed from. Mifepristone and misoprostol are incredibly safe medications. They're safer than ibuprofen. They're safer than Tylenol. And there was a recent analogy that was made that medication abortion is substantially safer than skydiving, which I think is an event that most of us would think of as being much more dangerous. Procedural abortion in the first trimester is typically a uterine aspiration, and this can happen with a manual or a handheld vacuum aspirator or an electric vacuum aspirator. Most typically in the United States and around the globe, we use the manual aspirator for the first trimester, and it just looks like a big syringe. This is a procedure that takes under 5 minutes most of the time during this first trimester time period. So procedural abortion most typically happens in an outpatient clinic, and that might be with or without various sedation type medications. However, it can also happen in an emergency department or in an operating room if patients do want or require more anesthesia or supervision. Medication abortion also can happen in outpatient clinics. It can happen through an emergency department, on an inpatient hospital unit if a patient is already admitted when they discover a need for medication abortion. It can be mailed. And if a pharmacy is registered, it can be dispensed through a pharmacy.
And again, that's Dr. Sarah Prager. She's an OBGYN physician and professor of obstetrics and gynecology at the University of Washington. She is also the director of the Family Planning Division at UW. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for KBOO News in depth. At 6, it's Rose City Native Radio. Then at 7, American Indian Airwaves. Tonight's weather. Clear skies continue down to an overnight low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow's weather. For Friday, more sunshine continues up to a high of 87. The high will reach 91 on Saturday. Today in history, on this date in 1940, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, who first took office in 1933 as America's 32nd president, was nominated for an unprecedented third term. The Democrat would eventually be elected to a record 4 terms in office, the only American president ever to serve more than 2 terms. For a quote of the day, we turn to FDR. We believe in democracy. We believe in freedom. We believe in peace. We offer to every nation of the world the hand clasp of the good neighbor. Let those who wish our friendship look us in the eye and take our hand. And now for the stories making headlines for the effect on our democracy today. Here's the latest edition of 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're tracking the 2024 election process from the Republican National Convention in Milwaukee.
Our country was flooded with cheap Chinese goods, with cheap foreign labor, and in the decades to come, deadly Chinese fentanyl. Joe Biden screwed up, and my community paid the price.
Newly minted vice presidential nominee Ohio Senator J.D. Vance struck a strongly populist and America First tone at the RNC. In an anti-elite speech that attacked Wall Street and multinational corporations, the former venture capitalist marked how isolationist the Republican Party has become under former President Donald Trump. On a day devoted to foreign policy and national security, the GOP shift came into focus. Vance famously once said he doesn't care what happens to Ukraine, and in the Senate, he voted against aid to the country. But taking a more traditional line, former Illinois Congressman Rodney Davis says the U.S. has to support NATO and Ukraine.
Russia's trying to rewrite borders. I'm a firm supporter of stopping aggression and aggressive behavior from evil dictators like Vladimir Putin.
The Biden administration came in for intense criticism for how the U.S. left Afghanistan, fulfilling a deal Trump made with the Taliban. Florida Congressman and Army vet Brian Mast lost both legs in Afghanistan and called the withdrawal a failure and an embarrassment.
Nearly 2,500 of my brothers and sisters gave their lives in that war. Joe Biden disgraced their sacrifice and the sacrifice of all Afghanistan veterans.
But support for Israel's war is extremely high, with many saying the nation would be justified in reoccupying Gaza and cleansing it of the Palestinian population. Annabelle Rutledge, with a pro-Israel group at the convention, Concerned Women for America, says as tragic as the civilian deaths may be, they are to be expected during a war.
There's a devastation that happens when war happens.
The topic of international threats bled into an already regular refrain at the convention. New Mexico delegate Amy Varela connected national security to crime and migration.
Open borders and the catch and release programs that we have, and so it is directly reflected, and we have to get Trump in there to protect ourselves.
The failed assassination attempt on Trump seems to have added to his tough guy image. Virginia State Delegate Amanda Chase emphasized the need for strength in the White House.
We need to have a strong president that is physically healthy, mentally healthy, and capable of making important, serious decisions, and who is willing to sacrifice his own life, his wealth, his family, his reputation, and his businesses for this country.
President Joe Biden is self-isolating in Delaware after testing positive for COVID. The White House says he is experiencing mild symptoms. I'm Farah Siddiqui for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
More than $27 million is coming to upgrade forests in the Pacific Northwest for recreation. Eric Tegedov has the story.
The investment is the latest round of funding from the Great American Outdoors Act, which was passed in 2020 and established the National Parks and Public Land Legacy Restoration Fund. The legislation is aimed to address the backlog of maintenance needed on public lands. Tracy Calazon with the U.S. Forest Service Pacific Northwest region says 23 projects across national forests in Oregon and Washington were chosen.
That is for fixing campgrounds, replacing toilets, updating trailheads, signage, kiosks, roads, providing access and accessibility improvements, really at the sites that the public knows and loves across National Forest of the Pacific Northwest.
There are now 76 Legacy Restoration Fund projects in the Northwest, with 18 of them completed. The U.S. Forest Service says the Great American Outdoors Act has brought $77 million in contracts to Oregon and Washington to complete these projects. Calazon says there are many elements to maintaining the country's forests.
It's not necessarily only the trailheads or the public-facing infrastructure. It's also the infrastructure to support the whole picture and make sure that we have the staff to be able to provide these great opportunities.
The Great American Outdoors Act is working to address the country's $8.6 billion deferred maintenance backlog on public lands. For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Meantime, as Mark Moran tells us, a fight is underway to save other western lands.
Nearly 10,000 Montanans have petitioned the U.S. Forest Service to prevent mining activity in the iconic Smith River watershed. The Smith is known for its majestic views and numerous wildlife species, but it's also a huge draw for outdoor enthusiasts seeking to disconnect. The Smith River Public Lands Coalition has called on the Forest Service to withdraw mineral leases granted to a company planning a $4 billion copper mine on private land near Sheep Creek, which feeds the Smith more than half of its water. Bozeman-based river guide Josh Seckinger estimates he's floated the five-day, 59-mile-long Smith 100 times. He thinks the copper sulfide mine drainage would be devastating.
It just decimates anything with gills downstream. So that's fish, that's amphibians, that's aquatic bug life. It's a terrible way to sterilize a river.
Mine developer Black Butte Copper says it is committed to preserving Montana's water while creating economic development opportunities in the state, and claims it can build the mine in an environmentally friendly way. Seckinger says beyond the environmental and wildlife damage the mine drainage could cause, it also threatens the local landscape and the recreational economy built around the Smith River. He says that isn't just a hit to the businesses, but to Montanans who want to experience the trip. It requires winning a permit in a state lottery.
And it is my hope that every resident of this state puts in for a lottery permit and wins so they get the chance to experience this place. Because once you experience it, you understand immediately why it needs to be protected.
Black Butte Copper has bought nearly 700 claims on the public land surrounding the one near Sheep Creek, potentially allowing the company to further expand its mining operations. This is Mark Moran.
A big meeting of tribes in Oregon tops today's edition of National Native News. Here's Antonia Gonzalez.
In Grand Ronde, Oregon, Native people have gathered to explore the role of tobacco in their culture. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, it's to challenge perceptions that commercial tobacco is traditional.
Health practitioners and family advocates, mostly from the nine tribes found across Oregon, are meeting at the Spirit Mountain Event Center. Ben Sanford is the Commercial Tobacco Prevention Coordinator for the Native American Youth and Family Center in Portland and a member of the Saponi Tribe of North Carolina. He's brought jarred samples of a Hopi leaf tobacco that he's helped cultivate.
It's earthy, it's rich, it makes my nostrils flare in the best way. When we think of the appeal to the creator of the fragrance of tobacco, it's everything I think it should be.
The aim is for Native people to switch from chain-smoking commercial-grade tobacco that's tar and nicotine and use more natural forms in a more reverent way. Shannon Lafferty is the coordinator of the Grand Ronde's Tribal Youth Empowerment and Prevention Program.
All the way up until this year, we have been giving packs of cigarettes or top loose tobacco as giveaways, and this is the first year that we actually used real tobacco, and I'm proud of that.
Native Americans have higher rates of smoking-related illnesses than the general population, a trend organizers want to fix. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Grand Ronde, Oregon.
The Boys and Girls Club of the Rosebud Reservation is the recipient of a farm-to-school grant program, among things to offer fresh produce all year. South Dakota Public Broadcasting C.J. Keene has more.
The Patrick Leahy Grant Program is run through the U.S. Department of Agriculture, and in total, $14 million has been distributed to schools and communities nationwide. The Rosebud Boys and Girls Club received just shy of $50,000. Rachel Kochak is the group's executive director. She explains where the money will go.
This grant would cover fencing and high tunnels and no-till gardens. So this means like outdoors in the dirt growing for up to 10 months of the year for the kids of the Boys and Girls Club, and would serve two of our site locations. So that would reach approximately 80 kids.
Kochak wants the group to experience food independence.
The goal is a love for growing and eating locally grown food. That's the vision of having that joy of like self-sufficiency, of feeling the accomplishment of working hard and pulling food out of the ground, and then the joy of eating it. Out here in Rosebud, food insecurity is a major issue. For most kids, like this kind of fresh garden food is just not accessible.
While favorites like peas and carrots are on the menu, Kochak says they hope to incorporate traditional diet into the garden.
The more diverse we can grow, the better. And hoping to incorporate to some of the local ancestral foods that would have been part of the diet. So perennials like chokecherries and juneberries and those things as part of the landscape as well.
Any excess crops will be donated to families in need in the Rosebud community. The Rapid City Area School District also received a grant and seeks to connect local education with agricultural providers. For National Native News, I'm CJ Keene in Rapid City.
In Oklahoma, tribal members and citizens of the Cherokee Nation, Chickasaw Nation, Choctaw Nation, Muscogee Nation, and soon the Seminole Nation will be able to use their tribal membership to hunt and fish in each other's treaty territories. The Intertribal Council of the Five Civilized Tribes recently announced the agreement. According to the tribes, the agreement allows the five tribes to collaborate on wildlife management within their reservations and enhance their ability to manage natural resources in a sustainable manner. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, July 18th, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Eric Tegedoff and Mark Moran. The producer's Annette Newell, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Public News Service and Native Voice One. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Annette Newell, so glad to have you with us. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News In Depth. That's coming up next.